Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Hello, TERFs and trannies. You are listening to Heterodorks.
Could you do that one more time, Nina, a bit sexier?
Hello, TERFs and trannies. You're listening to Heterodorks.
That's great. That's really good.
Thank you. This is the sexy episode with only sexy guests talking about sexy topics.
And we have brought back all of our sexy guests for this episode. Welcome back, Ben Appel.
Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be hanging out with you guys.
Ben is our sexiest guest.
I agree wholeheartedly.
We've gone through the roles.
And you've decided this is, it's official.
Well, yeah, we voted on it. It was a secret vote, but it was both for you.
Yeah. Okay. Corinna's vote carried a lot more weight than mine. Just FYI.
Okay.
Anyway, today we're going to talk about 12-step programs, which I have wanted to discuss ever since we interviewed Wilfred Riley, who made a few sort of disparaging remarks about AA, sort of casually, and I found myself wanting to argue with him, and it wasn't very good audio, and I think Corinna edited most of it out. But since that time, I've wanted to talk about various aspects, and you, Ben Appel, have written about AA recently. Can you talk about that article a little bit?
Yeah, I wrote for Unheard a piece. I think I didn't come up with the title, but I think they called it like AA has lost its way, or how Alcoholics Anonymous has lost its way.
It got woke.
Yeah, essentially. And it's about something that I began to notice in meetings, especially since Trump, but more so since like 2020, you might be aware that there's, and I write about this in the piece, that there's like, there are traditions in 12-step programs. And one of those traditions is tradition 10, which states, you know, that we have no opinion on outside issues. So hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. That's kind of the wording of the tradition. People endeavor to refrain from talking politics in meetings or outside, quote unquote, outside issues, because it can really alienate people who need help. Newcomers that come into the meeting, maybe this is their first or second meeting, and they're really having a hard time. They're struggling. They're desperate for help. They're desperate to find a community that can help them. They can't stop drinking. And then someone starts going off about this or that politician or this or that culture war issue or political issue, and they might disagree, or they think, shoot, I voted for the wrong person. I feel differently. So obviously I don't belong here. I'm going to be rejected. These people aren't my people. And so I might as well just head out, try to find something else, or, you know, keep drinking, keep using, and I can't get the solution that I need. I think it has the potential to really alienate a lot of people. And it really frustrates me when people don't heed that tradition and how vital it is to the survival of the program.
Well, there's another tradition, the 11th tradition, that says we need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, television, and film. But it doesn't say podcasts, so I guess we can just bash that. No, I'm kidding. Corinna is going to have to edit some things out. I really want to talk to you freely, and Corinna is shaking his head like, what are you talking about? I don't understand of this.
Well, I think that so with the 11th tradition about maintaining, you know, maintaining anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, that, as far as I know, that tradition was developed because really they didn't want spokespeople for 12-step programs. And we're talking about AA here because that was, you know, initially where other 12-step programs devolved from, you know, AA.
AA being Anti-Racist Anonymous.
Correct.
Right.
And so it really was like, we don't want spokespeople. We don't want to advertise for this program. One, we don't want to put out commercials. Come to AA. It's attraction rather than promotion, meaning that we attract members by just being open, being not drinking, people are, oh, wow, you really have your life together. I can't get my life together. How did you do it? Oh, well, you know, I do this program. And it attracts people rather than promoting it, going around, and et cetera. But also anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films, because AA really didn't want spokespeople to speak for the program. Where if you have this, let's say, a celebrity saying, oh, I'm an AA, AA saved my life, this is the way to do it, and then they end up getting drunk again, they end up drinking and falling off the wagon, then it reflects on AA, like, oh, here's our spokesperson, and look, it doesn't work. This program doesn't work, and people might doubt the efficacy of the 12 steps. So I think it's more about that. For me personally, in terms of level of press, radio, and films, I mean, we could just stick to saying 12-step programs. I do say AA, but for me, I think that it's like, those are specifically what those traditions are about. But for me individually, I am allowed as a human being to say, oh, I am in this program, or I am in a 12-step program. I'm not advertising for it. I'm not saying this is the only way to do it. You know, I'm just saying this is my history. This is what has worked for me, and something that I belong to for a long time. And I don't think that there's any violation of the traditions in that regard. People, listeners might disagree that are in the program. I'm not sure. I did get a couple kind of frustrated messages from, or comments from readers who were in the program saying it wasn't right to, I think they were really, it wasn't right to portray AA as a whole in this way, which obviously I wasn't doing. So I feel like they kind of read it wrong. You know, I wasn't critiquing the program. I was actually saying that for me, this program has really worked, and this, I fear that politics, social justice, the culture wars, and this encroachment upon meeting spaces is really alienating people. And it's not just me. Like, I know that this is happening for a fact. And I think that it is a violation of the principles of the program, or the traditions anyway.
Yeah. What troubles me is there is this incursion of a religion that is not identified as a religion. And 12-step programs are not supposed to have any specific religion. It's a spiritual program, but not a religious one. But genderism, which I think is a religion, does not identify itself as such. And so it slips in. And I actually, I went to a lot of Al-Anon meetings when I was living in New York. Then I moved back to Central Illinois, and I went to far fewer meetings here because the culture is absolutely different. So different, it's almost like a different program. But when I was getting canceled in my town, I really needed help. And so I returned to meetings, even though at least one person on Team Cancel Nina attended local Al-Anon meetings, which sucked. But I did find a meeting that she didn't attend regularly. And that was fine until the pandemic happened. And then there were only online meetings. But because there were online meetings, I was like, oh, I can attend my favorite old New York City meetings that I loved so very much and missed so very much. And about a third of the screen names on Zoom had their stinking pronouns in them while I was being canceled by adherence to this ideology. And I was seriously bummed out. I sat through the thing anyway, but I never came back.
Could I ask some basic questions? I don't want to invalidate your experience here, Nina, because I do want to come back to it. But what the hell is a 12-step program? Why is that funny? I'm from Nevada. We revel in sin. It's part of our school curriculum.
Well, then you probably have a lot of AA programs there.
No, I think they're banned by law.
Now, where there's drunks, there's AA.
Sin City, Nina. That's where I'm from.
Yeah,
sort of.
People love them there. It's those people that created and maintained them.
But seriously, what is the 12-step program? There's 12 steps you're supposed to follow. Because I'll tell you, my very naive understanding is, and you can laugh because I might have this really wrong, but you go to a meeting, you say something like, my name's Corinna, and I have this addictive quality. And everybody says, hi, Corinna. or they say Corey. There's some debate about this now. And then they might misgender you. And then after all of that, then somebody will be your sponsor, and you, whenever you feel like you're going to engage in this addictive behavior, you call your sponsor. And then after so many months, they give you a little coin that says you haven't done your addictive behavior in X number of days. And that, like, the first step is saying you don't have any power. And then that's everything that I know about AA. That's everything I know about 12-step programs. So the first step is like admitting you have no power or something like that. There's apparently 11 other steps, but I think step two is stop doing your addictive behavior. And, you know, there's 10 more steps after that. I can't even guess.
Do you want to take this, Nina?
I'm like looking at you. All right.
You go for it. I mean, I can answer it, but, you know, if you want to.
Let's each try. We might have very different answers. So the first 12-step program, the 12-step program, is Alcoholics Anonymous, which was started by a couple of drunks that had tried very, very hard to stop drinking and failed every single time. And I guess they... Oh man, this would require referring to the big book, which is like,
well, you're going into the whole history of it. I don't know if Corinna wants a history, like it's a complicated history, but really, can I jump in, Nina? Is that okay?
Perfect.
Yeah. So it did start in the 30s. It evolved out of different groups, that had come before it that were about abstinence. But then these two men started this program. They're known by as Dr. Bob and Bill, or Bill and Dr. Bob. Anyway, it's where people with addiction, alcoholics can come. They have meetings really every day. At the beginning, I guess it was maybe weekly or monthly, I'm not sure. As it grew, it became more often and more frequent, and then now it's around the world. And people go to meetings, they listen to people share their stories about what their drinking life was like and their habit, and then what happened to get them into the program and how they got sober and what it's been like since then. And so with then people, by listening to their stories, they kind of identify in and they say, oh, okay, this really worked for them, so maybe this will work for me. And then what happens is there is a big book. There is a book, a literature that it's called the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it's just called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's about what these guys did to get sober. So it's basically, it's not saying you must do this. It's saying, this is what we did. So that's how all of the steps are phrased. Like, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Like, it's saying, these are the steps we did. These are all suggestions. It's not a religious program. It's a spiritual program. This is how it works. And so people would follow these steps, like out of the big book. And, you know, with sponsors that had gotten sober before them, the sponsors would take them through and just essentially share their experience. And it's all through sharing your experience and passing it on. And part of the steps, too, are like doing a moral inventory, looking at all your resentments, getting all this stuff out, and then telling it all to, you can do it to a priest if you're a religious person, or you can talk about it with a sponsor, get all of that stuff out, those secrets that are haunting you and the resentments and stuff. And then you make amends to people that you've harmed so that you can kind of hold your head up higher and look people in the eye again. And it is a spiritual program, and it does, for a lot of people, bring about a kind of, they call it a psychic change or a spiritual awakening. You know, it sounds very woo-woo, but it's, for a lot of people, it really does kind of, it provides a reset for the way that they're approaching life and their life perspective. And meanwhile, by joining in the fellowship, going to meetings, and joining other people that are sober, they're staying sober just a day at a time. Like, they're finding, wow, I could never do this alone before. I tried. Every day I would get up and say, I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to use today. And then by whatever o'clock they were drunk again. And it's really fresh, because that's what addiction and alcoholism is like. You bang your head against the wall because you're just like, why do I keep doing this? I cannot stop, even though I'm desperate to stop. That's how it works. The 12th step is, you know, you're passing it on, like helping other alcoholics to get sober so that you can kind of, they say, give it away to keep it. You help other people. You keep coming back regardless of how long you've been sober. You never really graduate. You just kind of keep paying it forward to keep the program fresh and keep everything keep everything going. That's the theory. That's the program. That's the, those are the principles in a nutshell anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
In addition to the 12 steps, they have 12 traditions, which are designed to keep it from going off the rails and turning it into a cult or a business or a mess. And
right.
there are examples of projects where they didn't follow these traditions, Synanon being a prime example. Synanon was a cult that grew out of... do you know about Synanon, Ben?
No, I'm shocked. I don't know.
Oh,
about
yeah,
this.
You should Google Synanon. So,
S-I-N?
S-Y-N.
S-Y-N.
Synanon. So, the idea was all different kinds of behaviors. And it's true that there are 12 step groups for all different kinds of behaviors. And you can have one addiction, but understand or relate to people with a different addiction and a different recovery program. So, these people with different problems and compulsions and addictions had, they made a group and, you know, they found themselves a place to live together, to recover
nice.
Together, away from other people.
They can have 12 step meetings on the hour.
Well, what's SYN short for? What's S-Y-N? What's that short for?
SYN, like synonymous, I think. It's like, I think multiple, like the idea is synonymous or whatever the root of synonymous is. It's that same root, like lots of different issues. Doesn't have to be AA. It doesn't have to be alcohol. It doesn't have to be drugs. It doesn't have to be sex. It doesn't have to be this thing or that thing. It can be any of these things, all of these things. They're synonymous with each other and it's a spiritual.
Great. Yeah, totally. Oh gosh, that sounds like a nightmare.
I don't know. I mean, I've been to open meetings. They're fine. But the thing with this is that they made themselves the primary community of the participants, whereas what they say 12-step programs are a bridge back to life. They're not life. They're a bridge back to life. So there's a lot of emphasis on improving your family relations, improving relationships in the world and not replacing those relationships with program. But it sounds like Synanon was doing that, and that made it much more culty than was healthy or sustainable.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's, you know, there are AA specific groups, you know, it has the potential to be cult-like, and for individuals, you know, there have been meetings that I've gone to or the groups that I've thought, oh God, this is culty. I'm not into this at all. My antennas go up whenever I'm, you know, in a crowd or a space like that. And you know, but again, that is really what the traditions are for. To keep it from getting that way. But there are a lot of personalities. I think that anything that is an organization that involves a lot of people, has the potential to develop cult-like or fundamentalist tendencies. I really do. I've experienced it with businesses I've worked for with. I feel like there is a group think there's a, but with AA specifically, because it is a design for a way of living. And, you know, there's a lot of ideas that people really run with, like, oh, what I hear is, what drives me kind of crazy is like, oh, I'm crazy and I can't trust my thoughts. So I just call my sponsor every day to ask them what I should do about everything. I mean, this is kind of an exaggeration. It's kind of hyperbole there, but that it is kind of like that. I do hear that a lot, that there's this often like, you can't trust yourself. You have this diseased brain. Your brain's always, you know, your disease is always trying to get you drunk and get you to screw up. And so you have to rely on other people to kind of tell you how to live and tell you what to do. That freaks me out because I'm like, okay, that's culty stuff. And I get it that it's good to check your thinking and to reach out for help for sure. But the point of the 12 steps in the program is like what it says in the literature, like we became able to intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. Like, we experienced this change from working the 12 steps, so we can start really trusting ourselves. We're sober and we're leading this same, you know, there is a, I'm a person now. I'm a whole person. I'm a human being, and I can trust what's in me and what's in my mind. And I don't have to, there's parts of it that become really dogmatic. And wherever there's dogma, that's when I'm like, nope, I'm out of here. I can't do it. Can't do it.
Yeah. Also, programs attract a lot of crazy people.
Correct.
Hmm. About how many, what percent would you say is crazy, Nina?
I mean, well, you could say 100%.
Oh, okay.
But there are some people that they have more problems than just the specific behavior that brought them into the program. So they might be able to abstain from that specific behavior while engaging in some other questionable behaviors with other people. They might, for example, have real control issues. They might be very manipulative. And that is why the program is supposed to place principles above personalities, because there can be very charismatic, crazy people that people want to follow or listen to or trust and be very easily manipulated by them.
It's a lot of really vulnerable people in the program. So you really do. You have to be just, you know, cautious and find people that you trust. This is another thing, Nina, and it was interesting because when I was interviewing people for this piece that I wrote, one person that I interviewed was like, the one thing that you're not supposed to say, but is the truth, is that there are a lot of people in AA that are not alcoholics. And I'm like, you know what? Because, you know, they say like, when, if you come to AA, well, you're, there's a reason why you're here. You know, you're, people don't just come to AA and think, maybe I have a problem. Like, there's a lot of sayings in AA that people take as truth, and then they become kind of this dogma, and then you start repeating them, and then it's like, well, you know, is that entirely true? And there are a lot of people in AA that aren't, meaning, and I've, over the years, I've kind of listened to people's stories and thought, you just are lonely, you need a pro, you know, or maybe this is your issue, you're a codependent. But I think that there are people that come to the program for different reasons. And I do think that there are people who stick around and stay that aren't necessarily alcoholics. I do.
But there's so many other programs for them. There's Codependence Anonymous. There's Al-Anon, Friends and Family of Alcoholics, which pretty much everyone in the world qualifies for.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think some people, too, are just, you know, but I think, yeah. Have their lonely mood disorders, and not that there's anything wrong with that, you know, but some people do, and personality disorders and stuff like that. And I think that it can attract some of those folks as well.
Oh yeah. No, wow. It definitely does. And I kind of feel like Al-Anon, if there were a pretty effective treatment program for personality disorders, I think it would be Al-Anon or could be Al-Anon.
I agree with you.
Wait,
I
do. Run that again.
So Al-Anon is for family members and friends of alcoholics, recovering alcoholics, because it was started by Bill, one of the founders, by his wife and other really women, because AA was men in the beginning, who were like, that's great. You guys got sober. You have a support group, but we need a support group too, because you all are freaking crazy and you drive us crazy. And we've had to deal with your shit and your relapses and all of this. And this, you know, it's kind of comes from this idea that alcoholism isn't just a personal, it's a family disease. It affects everyone in your life when you are an alcoholic. And so what they did was they developed 12, they had the 12, same 12 steps. But they would work them as well. Like, you know, I am powerless over alcohol. I'm powerless over my partner's use, abuse of alcohol. I can't do anything to control it. It just, you know, people that are with alcoholics become enablers. It really does affect people in a really, really bad way. But it also affects people. It can make them very codependent, very walking on eggshells, kind of have obsessive compulsive disorder, where if they do behave this way, and, you know, do this, then their partner's not going to get upset, so they're not going to drink. But if they do this, then their partner will drink. And it becomes like this, you know, obsessive thing. And there's just, you feel like, in a way, you feel like you can control everything. And so it's a way to kind of relinquish that idea, and kind of, it is the 12 steps to get people healthy when they have alcoholics in their life. But what Nina was saying, like how everybody qualifies, in a lot of ways, I think that people really can benefit, because from my involvement in that program as well, it is a way to, you know, everybody has codependent issues. Not everybody, but a lot of people have codependent issues. I think that's like almost a universal thing, but yeah. It also just helps people really take care of themselves, and, but in a responsible way. You know, it's not like the selfish, like, oh, it's all about me. It's almost like taking responsibility for yourself, but in a kind of a caring and gentle way, learning how to parent yourself.
You learn boundaries there. Boundaries.
Boundaries. That's a good one. Boundaries.
Now, I'm confused. You mentioned Al-Anon. Isn't that just short for Alcoholics Anonymous? Al-Anon, Alcoholics? No, it's two different groups.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, that's not confusing.
I know. But just think AA and Al-Anon. Those are the two things for that involve alcohol anyway. The two founding groups, the original group.
Yeah. But Al-Anon is also, you know, for friends and family of crazy people, or really for anybody who is being driven crazy by other people, or if you're being driven crazy by yourself. Yeah, when I got into Al-Anon, I was like, oh, I would have qualified just by being me, because I drive myself crazy. I didn't have to wait till I had an alcoholic boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. All right. So for real, why would anybody want to be in an environment like that? It sounds like there's a lot of really intolerable people around.
Oh, yeah. It's horrible. It's like, why would anybody want that? No, it is. It's horrible. It's like, very few people want to be in that environment, because in addition, they're often in like church basements that smell, and, you know, they're just in these nasty chairs, and they're with these like weirdos. Like, you go into this room and there's a bunch of people sitting there who.
Yeah, I can see why you like the remote ones better.
But wait a minute. You're painting a very dark picture. Like, that is not accurate. Are you, you know, that's, I think, I'm hoping you're being like,
I'm being a bit facetious, but there's a lot. Okay, so I am talking about the before times, and I am talking about New York in the early, or the late 2000s. I don't want to say the late 2000s, but, you know, I started going to these particular meetings. I've been to a number of different programs before that, actually. But let's say 2008 to 2012 in New York. And some meetings were in really nice places, and they had very beautiful people in them, because it's New York. Mm-hmm. There were even, you know, occasionally famous people in them, movie stars and stuff.
Okay. Now I see why you'd want.
But I hate those people too. You know, it's like, I see beautiful people, and I'm like,
yeah. But you get
popular
to,
girls. I hate them.
You get to listen to the popular people talk about why their lives are terrible.
Actually,
that must be a pick me up.
That was quite life changing to see these perfectly groomed, perfectly coiffed, perfectly made up, blonde popular girl type people talk about their lives and their childhoods. That was really eye-opening for me. There was stuff going on behind the scenes with these people that I could not have imagined. And just sitting and listening to people, all kinds of different people, was really a good experience for me. It was one that I hated initially, like, oh, I have to sit here and listen to these people talk. But I, you know, even without any other aspect of the program, I thought, you know, I do live in the world, and the world is full of people I don't like. And it would be good for me to learn how to sit and tolerate that instead of running away every time I'm in a situation that I feel slightly uncomfortable in.
I don't know, Nina.
So it was like a bit of exposure therapy at first. And some people do not sound great. And some people do sound really dogmatic. And some people, it sounds like they're wasting your time. But at least once a meeting, I would hear something amazing come out of the mouth of somebody that I just never expected. And that's a really moving experience. And it brought me back to the human race.
That's powerful. And I think that, you know, for me, because there really are some really phenomenal. I mean, so many of my closest friends are the people that I did meet through the program, and they're some of the most phenomenal people, and they're the realest people in the world. They're the least, you know, they're the most, to me, authentic. And what I love about and admire about people that have been sober for a long, or gotten help for a long time, and thinking of my closest friend, or they've come from a really dark place. They've gotten their life together, and then living sober or without drugs or alcohol, whatever your addiction is, or, you know, living a healthy life is really, it's difficult because it's kind of a natural thing for alcoholics to drink about stuff. So it's kind of abnormal for drunks and addicts to be sober. And so it really builds up people are very, very strong because they walk through life and all of life's difficulties and everything that happens fully present for it and sober and awake, and they become really, really strong and wise. I've met some really strong and wise individuals, you know, over time. They become really less judgmental, or really approachable, again, authentic, humble. You can feel safe with a lot of them because of the work that they've done on themselves and how much work they've done growing.
Whereas other people just recite a bunch of slogans and a bunch of prayers and don't seem authentic at all, but there they are.
Right. Right. Yeah. And if you have a good bullshit, you know, gauge or whatever, you can spot those people pretty well. I don't know. Maybe people think I don't know. Who knows?
I feel offended a little bit. Like the only authentic people are the ones that have come through a 12-step program. I did not fill my body with exogenous hormones for 30 years and have all of this surgery to come across as authentic, Nina.
Wait a minute. When did I say the only people? Rewind the tape. When did I say the only people? I really want to know. If I said that, I take that back. I retract.
All right.
I didn't hear it. But, you know, Corinna's not cool like us because Corinna's not in a 12-step program.
Yeah. I'm joining one. I'm going to find one that has the most vulnerable people in it, too.
They all do. Don't worry.
I've got some designs. I mean, if they caught one cult going, I could do another one. Hey, you know what would be a good idea? Actually, this is probably a terrible idea, but I have an idea. How come they don't have a program for gender identity anonymous?
They probably will. I suspect that one might be formed by people who are trying to recover from that.
I've heard so many times parents of trans-identified teens and kids and then other people who detransition, they do talk about it as if it's an addiction. It becomes this complete obsession with gender. And suddenly you're viewing everything through this lens, just a complete preoccupation. So yeah, I think that there's something to be said there.
It's called a spiritual program, and many people get into trans stuff because they have spiritual needs, unmet spiritual needs. And that is the weird thing. That is the big barrier of 12-step programs in general, is that they are spiritual programs. People will use the G word. They'll refer to God if they're being a little bit more atheist friendly. They'll say higher power, but that's just a semantic difference. It is very weird to be confronted with that stuff when you're an atheist, which I still identify as an atheist, but I also don't. I mean, I'm aware that
Like, you're so Jewish.
Yeah.
You're so Jewish.
You're spiritually non-binary.
It's a strange thing. Like, I think people have spiritual needs, including myself. I actually think most people have religious needs. I'm not sure I have religious needs, but I have seen so many people benefit and heal from having some spiritual growth, including some religious practices. And addictions and compulsions are not rational. And irrational problems demand irrational solutions. Like, you can't necessarily fix the irrational problem of an addiction or a compulsion through rationality. We try that, right? Like, I mean, maybe some, it probably does work for some people, right? Like that podcast with Wilfred, he just stopped drinking. You know, I found other things to do and I moved on with my life. And I'm like, well, that's very rational. But some of us, that doesn't work. But then there's this irrational program. I mean, it's rational and irrational, but like spirituality isn't rational. It's just not that half of your brain using another half of your brain. And I thought in one of my earlier programs, like, well, you know, if I have this part of my mind that is susceptible to religion or inclined towards spirituality, inclined towards these irrational patterns, if that's like built into my brain, I might as well use it, right? Like, it's my brain, and it's like I have half my brain that I'm not using. And I don't understand how this works, but it clearly does, seeing other people. So I gave it a shot, and I'm literally of two minds about this stuff. I still am just as atheist and rational, but I also know that that lens doesn't work for everything, and that a different lens, stuff actually works. And I may never understand why, and I may never be able to analyze it, but it does work. And I have some problems where it works for me, so I do that.
I think that's well said, because I'm of two minds about it as well. I grew up very, very religious, so I recoiled from a lot of that, while at the same time being very drawn into it, because I was raised in religious fundamentalism. So it was like an attraction as well as, oh God, what the hell am I doing here? What am I entering again? What is this? And so it's been certainly a journey parsing through all of that. I required a lot of deprogramming. There was a lot of, I had no filter at the beginning too, because with authority, I would just kind of take what they said and adapt it to it, and then would feel guilty if I didn't do it right, or I was bad or whatever. I carried that from childhood. So, you know, with 12-step programs, all of it being a suggestion, I kind of took it all as dictate, you know, like these kind of, I must do these things, and I wanted to be perfect. And I really struggled with that for a long time. And what I realized, it took me a very, very long time to realize, to heed what a lot of people said from the beginning, but I didn't hear it, which was, you take what works for you and you leave the rest.
Wait, what does that mean?
Meaning that the suggestions in the programs, like everything, some things might not work. Like, I had a sponsor in the past who I had, you know, OCD scrupulosity. So I was an obsessive prayer. Like I was religious. I was had compulsions with prayer. And it was something that I developed when I was about 12 or 13. And it really haunted me for a really, really long time. Prayer is a part of the program. It talks about the 11th step, like continuing, you know, seeking through prayer and meditation. You know, prayer, they talk about, and it doesn't have to be religious prayer, but it talks about prayer. And he said, you know, prayer does not work for you. Like, it doesn't work for you. Like, this is a trigger. You know, he probably didn't use those words, but this is a sensitive thing. You have difficulty with this. Stop it. You don't have to. It doesn't mean that you're doing this wrong. It doesn't mean that you're not going to stay sober and get better if you don't do this. This does not work for you. And that was a lifesaver for me. It was someone giving me, you know, I was younger at the time, and I kind of did need permission from somebody that I trusted to not pray, but it kind of in the spiritual setting, but it really, really helped. I'll tell you, it has been a journey with that, because beyond AA, there is, you know, outside help. I've had to do things beyond 12-step programs, getting therapeutic help, professional help, etc. And a few years ago when I did a year of what was called EMDR, which is the trauma therapy. And that I did that for about a year. And that actually was remarkably helpful with rooting out dogmas and old ideas and behaviors and beliefs that I had inherited from other people that were still stuck, that I hadn't kind of fully dislodged, that were still kind of dictating my life and my choices and my behaviors and the way that I felt about myself in a lot of ways. And some of that had to do with the program. Some of it had to do with the 12, with, you know, I really was afraid to question dogmas or think about things to, you know, and I kind of was like, yeah, I can be honest with myself about stuff, about what I really, really think about things.
I recently, after years of very little activity, joined a new different 12-step program for a behavior, which I will not go into. But I am new in it. I'm like less than 3 weeks in and calling people and meeting people. And I had mostly great calls, a terrible call. I had a terrible call in this program. And the first thing, this woman who didn't know me and who I didn't know, first thing she insisted on in this call is that we recite the Serenity Prayer. And now,
what's that?
That is, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Is that an AA thing? Because I've heard that one before.
It's not. It didn't start in AA. It's used a lot. It's a popular. It's used a lot.
Yeah, it's a great prayer. I love that prayer. Mm-hmm. It's a great prayer, but the fact that she insisted and then that call was followed by her being horrible.
What were her pronouns?
You know, I didn't even ask, Corinna. I didn't even ask.
They weren't in her screen name? How did you know it's a she?
Yeah, I just guessed. Believe it or not, she was horrible in her own way. That is, not all horrible behaviors in this world have to do with genderism. There's a whole world of other terrible behaviors. Anyway, the fact that she started it with this has now put me on high alert for people that do this ritualistic saying of this prayer. And I was just like, I got nothing out of saying this prayer on the phone with her. You know, like, it's on the phone and it's out of sync and you're not even in the same room and it's weird. And I would much rather say that prayer by myself or under other circumstances. I certainly do not want to say it with somebody I've just met, even if they're in the program. And now I have a new trigger, which is, it was just so performative. It was so inauthentic. And I didn't feel like I was surrendering to a higher power. I felt like I was surrendering to this lady, which is exactly what she wanted.
Ooh, that's heavy. That's heavy. Do you pray, Corinna?
I guess it depends. Am I being pulled over by a police officer? Yes.
So you're like you're a foxhole prayer person.
Or just in the case that I'm being pulled over.
Yeah. Okay. Are you religious?
No. Okay. No, I'm not religious.
So are you an atheist?
I guess that's probably the best way to describe it. There hasn't been any more evidence that a God exists than there is that somebody's going to show up with a check for $10 million to my house. So I just don't count on it as being a thing I have to worry about, you know?
I see. Well, you're going to hell. Sorry.
I don't mind that.
We're already in hell.
We are. You're right. You're right.
I've been on Twitter for 10 years. It can't be that much worse. What about you, though, Ben? Are you religious?
No.
You were once, right?
I was once. I consider religion. I consider spirituality. I consider existence and existential stuff. I ponder, I think, I seek. I'm a truth seeker, I guess. That sounds like very, I don't know.
Yeah, you're also a Columbia writing graduate, right?
Yeah. And, you know,
truth seekers.
I'm what?
Truth seekers.
Right. Well, you know, I like philosophy. I like science. But ultimately it's just like, you know what? None of us know. I don't know. You don't know. We don't know. People that are, you know, I know what can work for me individually makes me, you know, happier. Sometimes I can be struck by this kind of, is that a coincidence? Or I'll just feel maybe a presence or a strength, or I'll feel loved or protected, or who knows? I mean, there can be a lot of feelings involved, and then there can be a lot of, then I think, oh, well, God is in all of us, you know, and I am trying to be the best version of myself, and I can connect with what's in me, which is the most truth that I can bring outside of myself. I mean, it's, what do I think? Where am I going? And what is my honest response to everything that's occurring around me? So there's a lot, you know. I think that religion does have value. I've talked about it a lot. A lot of people talk about this, you know, the kind of secularization of culture and society, leaves a big hole, I think, for a lot of people, and, you know, social justice in a lot of ways. And of course, genderism and all of that, it has filled that hole. You know, would they say, like, I guess ideological fundamentalism abhors a vacuum or whatever. And so there are people that with religion, it did provide a lot of people, or religious beliefs, you know, the traditions, the practice of going to church, of meeting with people, of doing volunteer work and so on, and having community. It does. And it did give meaning to people's lives. And some people are really looking for meaning. And so there are going to be new belief systems, new dogmas that fill that, because people do want meaning.
I've had conversations with Corinna where I've said that I really wish that I believed in God. I would really like that.
Yep. And then you reject me when I say, I'll do that. I'll fill that in that role for you. I'll be your God. And you're like, no. It hurts when people don't believe in you, Nina.
I believe in you, Corinna. But not that way, okay?
Right. Well, you know, I've heard that a lot, Nina. Like, I do. I've said that before, too. Like, I envy the people that are so, because it's like, oh, they don't have to think for themselves. It's just all been decided for them. God having this, I mean, believe, especially when it's a really benevolent God, and they feel like, yes, God loved. Because I was raised to believe in God, and there, I'm still kind of programmed in a way. I was written to believe in God. I was programmed to believe in God, but the God that I was programmed to believe in was not a very benevolent one. And so, especially for people like me, homosexuals. So I envy the people that just believe in the all loving, benevolent God and have no doubt about God's eternal love and favor. That absolutely. But then I also envy sometimes the folks that are really dogmatic, and they're like, you know, as long as I do this, 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 and this, I'm fine. I'm going to heaven. Everything's good. Everything happens for a reason. God's on my side. And that dogma does fill up a lot of space in people's brains. And it when you root out dogma, you're left with a lot of questions, scary ones. It's very existential. A lot of existential crises can occur. It's a lot.
Well, I wasn't raised with religion. I was raised with atheism. And I thought of religious people as pod people, like they had some kind of mind virus that frightened me. And as a child, I thought, we already have teachers surveilling us and judging us, and our parents are surveilling us and judging us. Why would we have an imaginary figure that's just there to surveil and judge us? Like, we have enough problems as it is. But my understanding of recovery is that if you have a conception or whatever, a relationship with a loving higher power, then you get the love that you so deeply need. And yes, I need that. I need, you know, I have an existential grief hole that would be soothed by a loving higher power. I have no problem conceiving of higher powers. They're all over the place. Time is my favorite one. I mean, time is like all around us. It affects all. It heals. Time does heal all wounds. So that's nice. But does it love me? What I really want is the sense that I am secure. Mm-hmm. It's like a proxy for what I assume is like perfect parental love, which nobody gets.
Right.
And I would love to feel secure. I would love to stop worrying about things that I can't control.
It's also like grace, mercy, just that kind of like a grandparent's love, just a pure unconditional love. But I'm going to talk about Jesus for a second. It's good to talk about Jesus. I started kind of reconceptualizing or kind of really thinking about Jesus again and about Christianity again after coming out of the social justice cult, or, you know, kind of really deprogramming, because in that world, there is no mercy and no grace and no forgiveness. And it's just an eternal struggle. And it's just, it's really, really bad. And it's very, there's so much scrupulosity and moral scrupulosity and judgment, and it's ugly. And so I was desperate to feel some kind of just grace and, you know, just to reacquaint myself with that concept. And so growing up, I did grow up in a Christian fundamentalist community, but what was so odd to me is I was kind of like thinking about Jesus more, about the principles of Christianity, about this idea of everything that you have done, you are forgiven and you're loved no matter what, and it's okay. You know, like, you're imperfect and that's fine, and I love you anyway, which was such a refreshing and kind of peaceful thought. I realized that I was raised in this Christian fundamentalism, but I wasn't really taught that. It was like that idea, the way that I came to believe it or understand it was, yes, of course we were taught Jesus loves you, etc. But it was like, but you must be this, 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 and this, and you must be perfect. And you might, you know, it was so much more about God being disdainful and disappointed in you and always vengeful and just ready to strike and at any moment. It was more a fear tactic. And so there was just so much guilt and so much shame. And I never really connected with that idea of, oh, I'm just forgiven and I'm good and I'm loved no matter what. I think that's why a lot of people who are quote unquote saved in adulthood, I think it's a really, that never had religion, but then they become born again because they, it's for the first time that they come to understand that there's this ideology that, oh, wow, everything I've done is forgiven. Like, I'm not a bad person. I'm just a human being and I'm going to be okay. And I'm loved no matter what. And I'm going to, you know, I mean, obviously with the afterlife, it does involve a lot of that, but it's just like, it's a relief for people to kind of surrender to that. And I think that's why it can be really powerful for people who are adults and become Christians.
And when you were saying that, I was thinking about genderism and this idea of like, oh, everything I've done before, it doesn't matter. I'm redeemed, right? Because I'm this other person.
That's a very good point as well. Very good. I mean, that's interesting. It's, I think that there are certainly some parallels there for sure.
Yeah. Born again. I mean, that's what trans, yeah. Were you born again? Were you like born as a woman, Corinna, when you were 18?
No, when I was from birth, Nina, this is how it works with trans. You're always you're assigned the wrong sex, but you were born the right one. There's no dogma to that either, so don't even try.
But did you feel, I don't know, did you get any of those needs met, or do you just not have those needs?
Which needs?
The needs to be, like, redeemed, right? Like, because it sounds like you just hate it, like, your malehood. My understanding of your story, if I'm going to frame it in these terms that Ben and I are talking in, is just a lens, right? But that malehood is, like, sinful. It's sinful and disgusting. But womanhood is this goodness. And you had a chance to become that. You wanted to be redeemed from your malehood, and all you had to do was sacrifice your body parts.
Nope. I've heard some D-trans males say that they had that sort of experience, but that's not mine. Sorry.
All right, then.
I know there. I should come up with... Oh, yeah, that's so insightful.
No.
That's exactly how it was for me. And yeah, I could become very sacrilegious from that point on, but I don't think I will.
Nah.
We'll save that for the Patreon episode. Ben, I want to bring back something that you had talked about in your article, and I'd read some other accounts of this in 12-step programs or these sort of support programs, is of, you know, let's say if you're an alcoholic, that one of the things that might happen after some time of not really having a lot of self-control is that you might develop some really ghastly habits. You might develop towards not having a very high regard for other people's needs or wants. And I guess this is some of the stuff that you're even supposed to ask forgiveness for. But when you start the 12-step program, you might come into it with some of this roughness to your character. And that, I guess, in some of these 12-step programs around the world, or at least around the country, that if you come in and you're looking for help and you have this sort of roughness to your character that you're hoping will be smoothed down or filed down a little bit by the 12-step program, that instead you're just ejected from the program. You're not allowed to participate because you're not already this perfect character. Mm-hmm. So is this like the gay bakery where, like, or the gay cake in the bakery where you have to drive past the 15 bakeries in order to find the one that won't bake your cake? Or is this starting to become a ordinary characteristic of the 12-step programs where people who really need the help and don't really have the accepting and tolerant personalities on their exterior just aren't able to find anything because they don't pass the fitness test before they're allowed to participate?
No, I don't know what look, there are so many meetings and it's all over the world. So people's experiences in different regions and states and areas are very, very different. Well, some people that read my article were like, wow, this is exactly how I felt. And then there are other people that are like, this isn't how it is for me where I live at all. Maybe it will be. It is a kind of maybe a more New York thing. I don't know. But in terms of like not being accepted or having a place, it's not so much because people are really accepting in the programs. Like we understand that people coming in, they didn't arrive in 12-step programs because they've just been winning and their life is amazing and they're sitting on top of the world and they're completely put together and totally, you know, had a normal childhood and they're whatever, just completely adjusted to life normally. So there isn't that. It's more like what my point was, that people have a responsibility, like the traditions say, you know, to make sure that we're just cautious of what we're saying, because we might be turning away people that might be thinking through what we're sharing in the meeting, oh, I'm a bad person because they're saying that anybody who voted for this guy is bad, or this guy is bad, or that's kind of what I was talking about. I'm sure there are probably people that come in and feel rejected or alienated, like they, you know, aren't polished enough or have it together. Maybe in some groups that could happen, but for the most part, I've seen different programs be really accepting and welcoming to people, no matter what shape they're in, because that's what's expected.
That's kind of interesting to me because it's, I haven't been to one of these programs. So, and if I had, then I guess nobody's going to believe me because it's supposed to be secret, right? But trust me, I haven't been to one, but it sounds like this 12-step program and the traditions are like the template for building a radically inclusive environment.
It is. Yeah.
If that's the case, how come that template wasn't used as a template for how we do these DEI trainings? Like, it sounds like we already have a good template for inclusivity.
Of the traditions is that we remain forever non-professional, and DEI is a for-profit enterprise.
True. And also, look, like you say, okay, we have, well, DEI, I mean, we have the Constitution, and, you know, we have laws and liberalism that implies and supports diversity, inclusivity, you know, equality. We have that, that has existed and it is improving, but there's so that you could say that as well. But yes, with 12-step programs, people do say, and I agree in a lot of ways, that it is a very kind of democratically ideal or ideally democratic structure and function because of how there are no leaders, the trusted servants is what it is. So the people that do work for AA, that they have less power than the group as a whole. Like it's a very, everybody has a say and a voice. Things are voted upon. There's a group conscience is what they call it. You know, there is an egalitarianism in.
That's why it doesn't work for DEI.
Right.
Right.
Because the egalitarianism.
Right. But, you know, yeah, well, I've heard rumblings that there are efforts to instill DEI in certain maybe regions or areas in 12-step programs. People did reach out to me and share with me scary information about people kind of starting to apply this very dogmatic stuff at the organizational level. I don't know how widespread that is or how prevalent or if it's really going anywhere, but, but again, that's just, I'm not saying that, oh, suddenly all these 12-step programs are going to be taken over by that, but someone did share with me some things. So I don't think that it's out of the question that DEI groups could infiltrate, if you will, some 12-step programs on the organizational level.
Well, that would be bad.
That would be very bad. It would be very bad.
You know, what's funny is I'm just going to go off topic here for just a second. Hopefully that's not too much of a diversion, but all of these attempts that have been really hammering on us for the last couple of years about inclusion, I've never felt so excluded from anything at all, because it's like, you have to get on the bus. You have to join this mindset. Everybody is supposed to believe all of the same stuff. And I'm really sort of like one of these people that sort of, I don't know if defiance is the right word, but I'm always scared when everybody starts thinking the same thing, because historically that's always been a marker that we're overlooking important things. So I don't want to get on that bus. I want to stand back a little bit and be able to ask questions and say, hey, is this really the right thing? But inclusion says, nope, not only do we not trust you to have any sort of curiosity, but now you're suspicious if you're not part of the program.
And you're talking about 12 steps program specifically?
No, I've never been to one of those, but I'm talking about
just inclusion,
like inclusion programs at work or in clubs,
right?
Or at your local gymnasium. Where, oh, we're inclusive. That means that
right.
Henrietta can use the ladies' sauna and please don't stare at her penis. Sort of
I mean,
stuff.
Given that, like, given that I was canceled by people that tout this ideology, it is obviously anything but inclusive. It's terrifying to me. Like, that word is a trigger to me. Mm-hmm. It means that I will be not only excluded, but persecuted, you know, denounced, lied about, and attacked.
Right.
Yeah, I've got a... So it's interesting because you're talking about, hey, we've got these sorts of traditions here. And you mentioned the word egalitarian, and it sounded like the citizen, what did you call it? The leaders?
Trusted servants.
Trusted servants. This is a lot more of a humble type of mentality of that when you come here, we have these traditions, we do want to teach them to you, but we're not fixing you. We're not fixing you. We're going to give you a context where you can figure out how to get yourself fixed.
It's interesting because, Nina, when you were talking about the traditions about like the anonymity of the level of press, radio, and films, and I was talking about how it's not like a promotional thing, and now I feel like this is veering into like promotional territory of like, oh, well, this looks, sounds like it's a really, you know, and I'm afraid that maybe am I violating the traditions by kind of defending it or talking about it in that way. I don't know, but we're just talking about something that exists. I don't think that that's, again, for all the listeners out there, I'm not saying that it does work, doesn't work. It's only way. It's just, this is what has worked for me in my life. And, I am skeptical in a lot of ways, and I waffle. I'm of two minds, like Nina said. But I was thinking about that. But yes, Corinna, with all that being said, with all of that, those qualifications, I do think that that is what is one of the things that's really admirable about the design of it. And it really is. And this was very important to me, so I'll just say specifically about me. Again, it really does not require you to believe or think anything. In fact, the tradition is the only requirement for membership. This is AA's. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. That's it. That is the only requirement. If you desire to stop drinking, you're a part of it. But you know what's interesting too, going back in the history of it, I mean, Carl Jung was a huge proponent of Alcoholics Anonymous, and his words are printed in the big book of AA because he endorsed this program as a clinician, as a psychologist, because he writes about how, you know, there are so many cases, because he would treat people that were drunks and that couldn't stop. And he said there were cases where the only thing, you know, because science is so rational, but he's like, the only thing that could get these people sober is some kind of, and he said, like, I think his words were, you know, some kind of religious experience, some kind of, in a way, burning bush moment, you know, that they had to experience this, and this was the way that it worked for them. I can't explain it. I just know that this is what it looks like. And there have been people that have come to me that I'm completely helpless to help. There's just nothing that I can do. And I say, hey, there are these people. This has worked for. This is what they've done. Connect with them. See if it works.
Irrational solution to irrational problem.
Right.
So I wish to remind our listeners that many of these meetings do take place in smelly church basements and have ugly, not beautiful people in them. So don't think that it's some sort of ideal democratic utopia. It's just as hellish as any other place on earth, except you get some recovery there.
Yeah.
Well, that sounds lovely.
You have to be very desperate. They say you have to hit bottom before you'll go to these programs. But then people try to, you know, raise the bottom so that people are not at death's door by the time they drag their ass in there.
Ben, I know you've been working your fingers off getting a book ready for next year. Can you give us any update on that?
Yeah. So I had my first draft. I'm in edits now, you know, came back from my editor. He's excited about it. It was, his edits were kind of like, and his ideas were right on, we're on the same page, and it's evolving. And I'm excited in the way it's evolving. It's kind of coming to be what it was always should have been. It's more focused, and so I'm excited about it. I do foresee that I will be finished by year's end. And so that's what I foresee. So it should be, you know, I'm thinking it will be out next year. It does take about 9 months from the final draft to get to publication when you're publishing a hardcover book, is what I've heard. So that's, you know, who knows, but I'm on track with it and it's coming along. I do have a couple pieces coming out, one in Daily Mail, US Daily Mail. It's like about a pride and my thoughts and feelings on pride. Kind of a, I don't know, maybe it's like a, it reads like a manifesto of sorts. I'm not sure, but that's, I don't know, maybe it's up now. I'm not sure. I was just emailing with the editor about 2 hours ago, but they might save it for tomorrow morning early. And then in Washington Examiner, I wrote about pride as well, and that should be coming out soon, but they also have the print edition there. So I wrote some things for those publications.
Can you share the title of your book?
It's called Cis White Gay, The Making of a Gender Heretic.
Could you please not use the word cis, though?
You know, it's like,
it's offensive.
It is offensive. And I don't like that word at all. So, you know, obviously I'm using it in a, I don't know if the word's facetious, not ironic, but in a way that I almost want to put scare quotes around it. Cis white gay.
You're reclaiming it.
I'm not reclaiming it. I'm kind of saying.
You're reclaiming it from the queers.
Yeah.
How about a title called Man Turf?
Man Turf. Okay. Well, but see, the thing is that I don't consider myself a turf in a lot of ways.
Neither are turfs. Turfs aren't exclusionary.
Right.
It's just a slur.
Yeah, it is a slur. So I don't know. I mean, yeah, I could reclaim that and say that facetiously, but I'm not a radical feminist and I'm not a trans exclusionary.
Yeah. Well, radical feminists tend not to be trans exclusionary, not for women. They don't exclude trans men.
Right.
Do you like that we're just deciding to workshop the title of your book out of nowhere?
I'm all for it. Tell me what else. Yeah.
Man
what
Turf. Else I just want to see a book called Man Turf. Maybe Corinna could write
man
it.
Turf.
Corinna could write it. Man I could turf. Write it. I'd just identify as a man.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way, I would like to take this moment to thank the listeners of Heterodorks on Twitter for voting me butchest lesbian.
Oh, who did on where was that vote taken?
A Twitter thread that Corinna started. Corinna said, "Who is the butchest lesbian? Wrong answers only."
Nice.
A lot of people.
And was it a multiple choice or did people just enter your name?
They just entered my name because I'm such a
wow.
I'm the butchest lesbianist, heterosexual, post-sexual, menopausal woman.
That's awesome.
You could write a book with that title.
Butchest, lesbianist, heterosexual, post-sexual, menopausal. That's a very catchy title. People will remember that.
Post-sexual.
I'm post-sexual, yeah. I'm done. I'm so tired.
Yeah.
menopause, which is not something that really happens to men, but for me...
Most men.
What? Yeah. For me... I'm pretty sure that the change in my hormone levels gave me great relief from an irrational and not particularly healthy attraction to men. And I am just grateful to not be driven into unhealthy and dangerous situations. And it is a blessed relief for me. That's what I mean by post-sexual. I mean, I still, there's yeah. like a little bit of something, but it's nothing. Like I was driven out of my mind in younger years. And I'm reminded of that because I just cleared out a bunch of merch from a space that we lost our lease on. And it included this book from 1993 that I made called, I think it's just called Nina's Adventures. I did a weekly comic strip. And in this particular book, it's like almost all of the comics are about men and me dating men and personal ads with men and being frustrated by men and disappointed they wouldn't have more sex with me as much as I wanted because I wanted sex all the time. And I am not joking that I was a crazed, horny young woman.
Fascinating.
Yep.
You know, you talk about this a lot, though, Nina.
Yeah, well.
I think you still have sex on your mind.
I have a lot of reflection on a life of doing these things that I'm not inclined to do now. And I'm looking and going, like, what the hell? That was a trip.
The number of leaps to go from workshopping the title of Ben's book to you talking about having sex with men, that was zero leaps.
Well, yeah, he said,
you just went for
Ben
it.
Said post-sexual. That's interesting.
Yeah, and then you were right there.
Well, because, you know, post what? It's like, I'm saying that post that.
You need estrogen, Nina.
You need testosterone, Corinna. I do think that the ideal thing for you is a cocktail of estrogen and testosterone.
Is that, let's talk about that for a second, can we? Is that,
sure.
Is that a thing?
Folks,
okay. For trans-identified people or people with transsexual histories, they'll do a cocktail of estrogen and testosterone?
This is not something that is normally done, but some people who've no longer have gonadal function.
Right.
Are trying to find some sort of mix that feels okay.
Wow. Yeah. It makes a lot of sense.
Cool. Because
I got it. The technology for delivering testosterone is not as refined as the technology for delivering estrogen.
So the.
Really?
The gender doctor told Corinna that his estrogen levels were postmenopausal. And so they suggested that he up his dose. So he experimented with that. And I am postmenopausal. And the thing is, postmenopausal women produce testosterone. That is why we grow fuzzy little mustaches. So I don't know what happens to a, well, Corinna is, of course, ridiculously youthful physically, despite his age, but he will be getting older and maybe he will show evidence of aging like a normal human being at some point. But anyway, they're just bandying around this, oh, postmenopausal levels. And it's like, yeah, but where's the testosterone? You know, like menopausal, like we need testosterone. Women need testosterone. We have it and we need it. And even though my ovaries are shutting down, apparently they're producing some estrogen and some testosterone still. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, what about, I mean, why is that not taken into consideration for someone like Corinna? I'm sure that I'm benefiting from having some testosterone in my system, even though, you know, a lot of women hate their little postmenopausal mustaches. Mine is blonde, so I don't really care. But we need it for energy.
I feel like your history of hypersexuality, if you want to call it that, or profound horniness, doesn't that kind of, I feel like that I would assume that meant your testosterone levels were pretty high naturally.
I have no idea. No. They were never tested. Yeah.
Because I do think that folks that go on testosterone, I do think that it really ups their sex drive significantly.
If you take a lot. I mean, we're talking about really low doses, really small amounts. I don't know what was going on with me hormonally. I don't think, I'll never know. And I think maybe, but also maybe not. I've had my hormone levels tested once in my life. When I was 50 years old and having some medical problems that led to a hysterectomy. I'm very grateful for that. And I just visited my doctor and said I would like my hormone levels tested. And she said, no, that's alternative medicine.
What?
Yep. No hormone level test for me.
I'm so confused by that.
I was confused too. Apparently the way my doctor's office works is they will order tests if the tests will lead directly to some treatment generally involving the prescription of drugs. And she said,
I see.
She said, well, but if you, what if you find that you have strange hormone levels? It's not like we would prescribe anything for that.
This is why you need to go to a gender clinic to get your estrogen.
Yeah.
They won't even ask you anything. They won't even ask you what your sex is. That's that's a prohibited question.
I'll fool
them. You just tell them that you're a man.
Yeah.
That feels like you ought to be a woman, and they'll give you estrogen.
I mean, look at this hair. I have short hair, right? I'm super butch.
You are.
Yeah, but they'll give you testosterone. You want to tell them that you're already a man, that you want to be a woman.
My hair is shorter than Ben's hair. I am butcher than Ben.
You are definitely butcher than me, that's for sure.
With my high squeaky little laugh. I have a super butch laugh.
I have a pretty squeaky cackle myself. But you know, gender is a performance.
But I'm not even gonna use that word. I have short hair, okay? I have short hair and I'm short hair and I don't wear makeup. That means, and I'm postmenopausal. So like a clownfish, I have changed sex.
I think we covered the 12 step pretty well. And then we talked about Nina's sex life. This is a requirement.
Let's talk about Corinna's sex life.
So thank you for joining us, Ben.
Thank you for having me. I love talking to you guys. I do.
Thanks, Ben. Bye, TERFs and trannies.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks, or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.